From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in early September when Siena Polling was attempting to answer a question. Was Joe Biden in danger of losing support from his left? Siena polled voters in six battleground states. Before I reveal some of the results, ask yourself what your expectation is here. There has been a pretty consistent narrative in this election season. It sounds something like this. Joe Biden has centrist or moderate Democrats wrapped up. He'll lose some support from his left flank, who might vote Green or even for President Trump. Well, the results are essentially the opposite. Supporters of Bernie Sanders in the primary were siding in this poll with Biden 87-4. Supporters of Elizabeth Warren were with Biden 96-0. Zero. Even Joe Biden's own primary supporters weren't that committed to him. Biden primary voters are supporting him over Trump 96-1. Now, in the so-called centrist lane, Biden is rock solid, if slightly less so. He's got Buttigieg supporters 92-3, the most solid number from that group of candidates. Biden has Bloomberg supporters 81-8. He has Amy Klobuchar supporters 82-9. What does this tell us? Well, for the most part, the left has coalesced around Joe Biden, who got stomped in Iowa and New Hampshire and appeared to be just about politically toast after those early contests. But why is Biden even stronger with Warren and Sanders supporters than he is with so-called centrist Democrats? And can he hold that coalition together? Polling shows that Republicans are very much unified around President Trump. Last winter, with the primaries unfolding, Democrats worried that they might not be able to unify in similar fashion, whether it was Bernie Sanders or Pete Buttigieg or Joe Biden or Elizabeth Warren. Well, our guests this hour, you'll hear multiple guests this hour, they are Democrats who did not back Joe Biden in the primary. And the question is, where are they now? How do they see the race now? How do they see the issues that impact the support or not of Democrats? Our first guest is Robin Wilt, a member of the Brighton-Town Board, a former candidate for Congress, and she supported Bernie Sanders in the primary. Robin, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much for having me, Evan.
Later this hour, you'll hear David Zavak, who has experience in politics and supported Amy Klobuchar in the primary. And in just a moment, we'll welcome Jay Levine, a longtime Democratic volunteer who supported Elizabeth Warren in the primary. Robin, I'll start with you here. Any of those numbers surprise you when it comes to the various supporters of other candidates and whether they've coalesced around Biden or not?
Not particularly, because I think in this election, what is at issue are the issues. And I think the opposition, that is the Republican opposition, is so far afield from any standards with regard to what we would perceive as capable governance, that people are voting according to that. So, you know, when you see these existential threats presented, I think people coalesce around those issues. So,
well, and so if you go back to the last debate, Vice President Biden, I got to be careful. I'm not looking ahead here. Vice President Biden was talking about something like fracking, and he was very defensive of fracking, saying that he's not in favor of banning it at this point. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez went on to say that this was not a problem for her, that she understands his position and that she looks forward to lobbying him on it. As someone who does take that position, Robin, are those kinds of comments from the vice president, former vice president, concerning to you? I mean, how do you see those issues?
Well, we definitely have our work cut out for us. And I don't think that there is any more love for Joe Biden than there was during the primary season. I think that the opposition is so anathema to everything that we believe and hold dear that people feel a need to back him so that we can at least have those conversations, which are total non-starters under the current administration.
Yeah, and so I guess before I turn to Jay Levine for his thoughts, as a former Sanders supporter, have you softened at all for Joe Biden? Has there been anything in the last 7-8 months that made you say, you know, he's not as bad as I thought?
I think we knew who Joe Biden was, and that is why we supported Sanders. So I don't perceive that there's any difference in terms of who he was during the primary and who he is now. He always had those positions, and I have been one who is supported Sanders because of his policies positions. And you know, asking me whether I've softened my affinity for Joe Biden is really asking me whether my morals have changed or my values have changed, and they have not. And so, you know, I understand who he is, and I understand that I need to lobby the Biden administration if they are successful in winning the election in order to come around to the positions that we hold.
Talking to Robin Wilt, a member of the Bridgetown Board, a former candidate for Congress who supported Bernie Sanders in the primary. And we mentioned at the outset some of those numbers that Sienna found in early September. And Jay Levine joins us, who is a longtime Democratic volunteer organizer who supported Elizabeth Warren in the primary. Jay is very familiar with those numbers that I read at the top of the show. Even Elizabeth Warren supporters are more for Joe Biden than Joe Biden supporters. 96-0 to 96-1. Jay, you're an Elizabeth Warren supporter. How in the world is that possible?
Which part? How is it possible that I'm an Elizabeth Warren?
No. No. How is it that?
I mean, she was simply the best candidate and wasn't even close. So that's why I was Elizabeth Warren.
Okay. So how is it that you think that because there is this narrative, as we mentioned at the outset, Jay, the narrative for months has been that Biden would be able to sew up centrist Democrats, the so-called centrist lane, the Buttigieg's of the world, Amy Klobuchar, et cetera. And, you know, he does fine with them, 82-9 with Klobuchar supporters, Michael Bloomberg, 81-8. But it is not that way when it comes to Warren. It's 96-0 in the swing states, zero for Trump. You know, and we were sort of laughing that even Joe Biden supporters from the primary are 96-1. That's what I'm wondering. How is that possible? How is it that Warren supporters are more for Biden than Biden supporters were?
Would it be okay to say Warren supporters were just better people? I don't know I don't know how else to put it. You know, I think the Warren supporters.
No, that's not okay.
Was a well, it was. I think Warren supporters are pretty practical. I think Warren is pretty practical. You know, I think there's where there were differences between Warren and Sanders. A lot of them do come down to practicality. A lot of them do come down to, like, did you really believe that there was going to be an actual revolution, or were you just looking for the most progressive, you know, smartest, best policy candidate? And then that's sort of the difference between those two things. I do need to point out that, you know, while there is this humorous difference that you point out, that Warren supporters support Biden slightly more than Biden supporters do, we're talking about a 1% difference.
Yeah.
Well within the margin of error for the poll. So it's not really a difference. But I do think that, and also the 1% difference is not really in Biden support. It's in, there's the 1% of Biden supporters that are supporting Trump versus supporting third party. Whereas for, you know, it's 1% and 3%, whereas for Warren supporters, it's 0% and 4%. I guess I would just say Warren supporters are extremely clear in their minds that it's not Trump. That I would just put it that they nobody is more clear in their mind that it isn't Trump than a Warren supporter is.
So let me ask you why that is, because we just heard from Robin Wilt as a Sanders supporter, you know, who has no deep love for Joe Biden, but sees this as sort of almost an existential threat to many of the progressive ideas that she holds dear if Trump is reelected. What is it for Warren supporters? Because there was that narrative, Jay, that, you know, he was going to have to work harder to get the progressive flank and that he would lose some of the progressive flank, that he'd be rock solid in the middle. You know, essentially, if you want to say that it's been flipped, it's the other way around. And the media narrative has been wrong. Why is it wrong, especially with Warren supporters?
Well, I think the first thing I would say is that it's not about the existential threat to progressive ideas. It's about the existential threat to democracy. It's about the existential threat just to the human race. You know, that it goes beyond a policy disagreement about Medicare for All or something like that. It really is about the existential threat, period. We can just end the sentence there. So there's that. And then there's I think just the fact that this has sort of been there all along, that, I mean, if you think about it, it really is a pretty simple logic that Trump is the farthest away from Warren supporters, right? And the farthest away from Sanders supporters. It makes sense that moderates would be less objecting to Trump than progressives would be. That makes sense. If you think about the issues that divide moderates and progressives, whether we're talking about universal access to health care or climate change or taxation, or if you're talking about criminal justice reform, Black Lives Matter, you know, these are things that matter less to moderates. That's an extremely broad and maybe even unfair characterization, but given that we have to make generalizations here, that's what we're talking about. I think all those things are fair to say. You know, it's the moderates who took 7 or 8 years to start saying that Black Lives Matter. So, of course, it's going to be the progressives who are the most against Trump. That actually does make sense, even from just a pure policy standpoint.
That is interesting. Robin Wilt, do you agree with that?
I absolutely do agree with that. Part of the reason that a lot of Sanders supporters have been in the streets in support of Black Lives Matter is because of this existential threat. And that issue is definitely on the ballot. Even if it doesn't necessarily have a champion, that issue is on the ballot. And people are literally voting for their lives.
Well, let me take a first listener comment. Don writes to the program and says, I'm really curious about how well your guests think that a coalition like this on the left will hold together under a Biden presidency. My own feeling is that the left will quickly forget about their common enemy once Trump is gone and commence infighting. Robin Wilt, what do you make of that?
Well, I think that power concedes nothing without a demand. And so everybody fully expects to have to convince a Biden administration that the policies that we've been championing all along are things that he should pursue during his presidency. And so it's not so much infighting as continuing the fight for these policies that we've held dear all along.
Jay Levine, what do you make of Don's email?
Well, I agree with our other guest. I think that, you know, first thing I would just sort of question whether infighting is actually even a bad thing, and that we should start to maybe grow up a little bit as far as our approach to politics and activism in this country. And we say presidential election, in a way, is this big, dumb thing that we must do every 4 years. And since we have to get, 160, 170 million Americans to agree on someone, it's not going to be a perfect person. It is going to be this sort of muggy, foggy, compromise type of person a lot of the time. And that what we should do is be completely committed to voting, vote for the best, you know, choice that we can get, and then resume sort of a robust struggle to arrive at the best policies possible in between the elections every 4 years. So I think on the one hand, we sort of take the nominating process a little bit too much to heart, and we haven't in the past taken the election itself to heart enough. But, you know, we really should sort of separate election struggles are what they are, and then the, you know, struggle to mobilize and push for policy. And a lot of people have said one of the main failings of the Obama administration was that in between elections, there was nowhere near enough mobilization to sort of keep the supporters engaged and to keep the supporters applying pressure on legislators to actually enact the agenda that we had supported, that we had wanted to. And then we didn't even show up for midterms during the Obama administration. And that is a major part of the, you know, problems that we have now. So I don't think there's necessarily anything wrong with the idea of, like, let's go back to infighting. The one corrective I will make a little bit to the premise is that so much of what Biden will need to do if he can take power in January, so much of what he will need to do are major thrusts that are still in the sort of unified realm. They're major thrusts to protect democracy. They're major thrusts to, you know, to have a coronavirus, you know, to have finally have a real national strategy. There is a great deal to do before we get back to the infighting, I think. We'll see.
All right. And I want to go back to about a year ago on this program. We had a panel of Democrats from across the spectrum, and Elaine Spall is a former member of Rochester City Council, and she said on the program a year ago, she said, guys, it's going to have to be Biden. We have to go with the safe, winnable choice here. And I mean, the look in the room, and this was like a different era because we had in-studio guests. It was like a different time here. We were allowed to see people in person. The look in the room in this studio of the other guests who were progressives when Elaine Spall said it's going to have to be Biden, I mean, they could shoot fire from their eyes at that. It was like, Joe Biden, really? Come on. We've got 16 possible candidates, including some really progressive choices. We're really going to go. We're going to do that. And Elaine basically made the case a year ago. Yes, we're going to have to if we really want to win this. And you know, here we are a year later, 6 days away from voting. I don't know if that was a prescient comment from her or not, but Jay, I asked Robin, you know, if she's softened a little or changed her views of Biden at all since the primaries. She said essentially no. She knows who he is and she knows the work ahead even if he wins. I want to ask you the same question because you didn't support Biden in the primary. It was hard for me to even find Biden supporters during the primaries. It was a very strange time. Have your views on Biden changed at all since the primaries?
It was hard to find Biden supporters unless you went to the polls.
And that, well, you're right.
It suddenly became very easy to find Biden supporters, as it turned out. That was my views changed on Biden. I think probably not enough is made of the sort of strides that have been made, not in necessarily electing progressives, but in getting liberals, and we'll call them traditional liberals, to become more progressive in their, you know, in their service in Congress and in their sort of in their runs for president. In that, you know, Hillary Clinton was running the most progressive platform of any nominee ever. And she worked with Bernie Sanders, and they made the platform even more progressive. And what Biden has now is more progressive than that. It's bolder. And I don't think that it's more radical, but it's bolder in achieving the kinds of policy initiatives that the majority of Americans actually support, which is sort of so much of the premise of Bernie Sanders' campaign from the very beginning, that people actually want this, right? I don't think anyone could have predicted how far Biden would go in forming all of these unity panels where they put together a group of Biden top advisors and a group of Sanders top advisors. And they came together and tried to come up with more unified policy proposals that essentially became the Democratic platform. And I know in particular the climate change panel, the Sanders and Biden people had trouble finding things to disagree about because the Biden people were actually very serious about climate change. And I mean, it's true. I mean, it's sort of he's avoided being saddled with sort of AOC buzzwords like Green New Deal. But it's a very, you know, I think Bernie himself would, I mean, he has said, like, wow, this guy has really come a long way, like longer than we might have expected. So I don't think anyone should, first thing is, I don't think anyone should be talking about this without really having read up on the proposals, that which I think a lot of people are, you know, on social media do very carelessly. And I certainly don't take for granted how far Biden has come, how far he's been willing to go on a policy level.
Okay. Listeners, I'd love to hear from you on this. I mean, if your views on the former vice president have changed since the primaries last winter, when at the outset of the primaries, Bernie Sanders looked very, very strong. I mean, certainly not certain, but on his way, perhaps. And Pete Buttigieg looked like the main contender against. And then things flipped and it moved very, very quickly and probably very pragmatically. I mean, there's a lot of truth perhaps to what Elaine Spall said a year ago on this program, to how the party eventually felt. And so I want to hear from listeners if you feel that there is enough unity, enough momentum and enough cohesion to get this done, because Republicans feel like on their side there is enough cohesion to get this done. They're very much coalesced around this president. It's 844-295-TALK, toll-free, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994, or email us, connections@WXXI.org. Claire emails the program to say, Evan, it sounds like the glue holding the Democratic Party together is a hate for Trump and conservatives. So who's responsible for all that division and hatred? Of course, this is a rhetorical question, but one that most often gets placed on the back of Republicans. So Claire, I'm strongly hinting that Claire is blaming Democrats or the media for that and not the people in power. Robin Wilt, who is responsible, Claire is asking, for all of the division and hatred going around?
Well, I think that the current administration is running on a platform of division and hatred. And I don't think that this side of the aisle is responsible for that at all. I think that what we've seen is unifying a unifying voice in opposition to the hatred that has been sown by this administration. And that is not what is keeping Democrats together. I mean, Democrats, I think, are pretty solid in the policy positions that they would like to see implemented. And I think the bones of contention, we saw those during the convention when we had opposition to the platform, because unlike what Mr. Levine has suggested, this is not the most progressive platform that we have seen. Hillary Clinton's platform is definitely more progressive because it contained the aspiration for Medicare for all. This is the first time in over a decade that the Democratic platform has not had an aspiration to that. So
you don't think that was mostly just lip service, though?
What do you mean? The fact that it's not like there?
The Biden proposal on health care has a lot more detail and a real teeth in terms of saying this specifically is what we're trying to do right now, as opposed to having the same vague aspiration, like, wouldn't it be nice if someday we could do this?
No, I think that actually the proposals for Medicare for All are very well thought out and detailed, and that there has been a rejection of that by those who control the party at the moment. And that is
what you're saying. Hillary Clinton had that proposal for Medicare for All in her platform? I don't think that's correct. She never supported Medicare for All at any point.
Well, I think Obama did, and
he supported it in theory, but he never supported it as an actual proposal to go forward. He said, if we could start over from scratch, I'd look at single payer. But he never said we're going to propose single payer. He never ever.
But it does sound like what Robin is saying is that from 4 years ago to now, there is less zeal among the people who are right now controlling the party to actually push in a direction of getting something like Medicare for All or single payer done. It sounds like, Robin, it sounds like what you're hearing from Joe Biden when he says Biden care, that was the term he used in the last debate, Biden care, which is basically Obamacare with a public option, the Affordable Care Act with a public option. It sounds like when you hear that, you hear, okay, done deal, he thinks that'll be great, and then we all move on, as opposed to an incremental move toward Medicare for All or a single payer system. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's what I hear.
Okay, and that's obviously a disappointment to you.
Yes, it's a major disappointment to me, especially in the age of a global pandemic, when we also are suffering from a financial crisis where people are losing their jobs in the millions, in the tens of millions, and we can't agree that Medicare for All should be something that we should provide. Provide the residents of the United States. It's unconscionable to me. It's unfathomable. It's immoral.
But it hasn't lost your voter, especially if you are a swing state voter. And it sounds to me like, listeners, if you're just joining us, Robin, among others, have made the point that the goal is to kind of get past the Trump administration and then start trying to move the Biden administration. Jay feels like Biden has really been moved already pretty far, or at least farther than he was. And that's maybe where our guests, Robin Wilton, Jay Levine, differ a little bit. Robin, it doesn't sound to me like you're as convinced that Joe Biden has already been moved significantly left.
Yeah, I don't think that he's been moved significantly less. And actually, I think the perception is that, you know, really on the left, that a number of the policy distinctions that he's drawn have been rather a slap in the face. It's almost like he doesn't care about our vote. So moving forward, we definitely need to lobby him on these policy positions, which I think make common sense, especially given the crises that we're facing right now, is a crisis of not only healthcare, but also in terms of economics, in terms of the environment, and in terms of racial justice.
Well, so I'm going to let
I'm sorry. I really have to take issue with what she's saying about this. And the reason is just that, you know, first thing is, Biden care is more than just Obamacare plus a public option. There is a very, very substantial increase in, you know, in the Medicaid expansion and in subsidies for working people and the working poor, and especially for kids. It goes a lot farther than that. And if it's true that if we reduce everything to the litmus test of a checkbox, are you for Medicare for all or are you not for Medicare for all? Yes, of course, you can't check that box for Biden, but you can't check that box for most Democrats in the Senate. I'm not sure there's even 20 votes for Medicare for all in the Senate. And as you know, it will take 50, you know, at the very least. The Biden platform is a substantial, very substantial advance toward, you know, toward universal access, healthcare access. And it's not, I mean, listen, I've been supporting single-payer healthcare since, you know, 99% of Americans had no idea who Barack Obama was. It's been a while, all right? So I'm on board with the policy, but the fact is you have to put up a nominee who can capture a majority of Americans' votes, you know? And to me, it's about progressives have not sold Medicare for all to the public enough yet. Because when we sell the public on it, we're going to have Congress. We're going to eventually have the Senate. Medicare for all candidate is not electable right now.
Okay, go ahead, Robin.
I don't want that to be the case, but it is.
Okay, Robin, go ahead.
I disagree. I disagree wholeheartedly because the poll numbers show that Medicare for all is something that is supported by 63% of Americans. That is regardless of party. And when we get into solely...
It's not regardless of taxes. The minute you start telling them about their taxes going up, those numbers completely change. And even though it shouldn't, even though it doesn't make sense, you and I agree on the policy. All right, but the support for it is incredibly soft once you bring taxes into the discussion.
If your taxes go up less than what you pay in premiums this year, which is
you and I agree on this. We're not talking about whether it makes sense. We're talking about whether the voters are there yet.
All right, Jay, let her go. Go ahead, Robin.
As soon as you explain that, people are on board. And I think most people do understand that. I think that those who are cynically saying that your taxes go up are people who really can't embrace the vision of Medicare for all. And those are people who are in a position, quite frankly, of privilege where they don't need to worry about Medicare for all. If you are out in, you know, among the communities that support Medicare for all, you understand that this is about life and death, and we need to advance policy that supports everyone and not just the privileged few.
Well, I'm going to ask about one more issue with Jay Levine and Robin Wilt. Jay, who supported Elizabeth Warren in the primaries, Robin Wilt, who supported Bernie Sanders, both eager to see Donald Trump lose next week. And a question then becomes, you know, how do you handle policy making and what direction does the party go? And so that's at kind of the core of this. And so when you look at whether the candidate, Joe Biden, has moved left, you go back to what he said in the primaries and you go back to what he's been pretty consistent on, which is very, very different rhetoric from Sanders and Warren on the people who control the most wealth in this country. He has been very defensive about not maligning billionaires, not maligning people who have the most money, the 1% of the 1%. And so I guess let me start with Robin on this. I mean, certainly Warren and Sanders had a very different approach there. Have you seen movement in the direction from Biden there? And frankly, how important is that issue to you, whether it's on taxation, policy toward Wall Street, policy towards banking? How important is that to you?
Well, it's extremely important to me because I think the current wealth disparities that we are experiencing, they're utterly unsustainable. And in particular, with the crisis of the pandemic, we're going to see homelessness and job loss on scales that we just couldn't imagine. In fact, if we look at the job losses and contraction in the economy during the Great Depression, they are actually less than what we've seen during this pandemic. And so we have not done enough in response to these economic crises that we're seeing. And our most vulnerable populations are the ones who are on the front lines and dying in disproportionate rates and suffering the burden of our lack of attention to these economic disparities. So this is an issue that is of utmost importance to me. I think that in order to come out of this pandemic with any sense of economic future, we need to make sure that we bring everybody along. And that's addressing some of the systemic issues that we had before. Right now, we've just increased our deficit to historic levels. And that was on the backs, again, of our most vulnerable communities. And we did that in order to give our most privileged communities a tax break that they didn't need.
Jay Levine, what do you make? What do you make of this one, especially with the idea that during this pandemic, economic policy is urgent, and what happens next, whether it's Congress or the White House setting the agenda, is urgent?
I would agree with what she was saying on policy. I mean, obviously, Warren was no shrinking violet when it came to talking tough against the 1% and income inequality. And I would like to see something a lot stronger from Biden in that area. I think a lot of it is just a preference for a different style and a different kind of rhetoric. He's not interested in talking about class warfare. And I think that's a political choice that he makes. I think that, he's very interested in talking about and would rather frame everything in terms of, do you work for a living? Here's what I'm going to do for you and your family. And he wants to frame everything that way, rather than framing it about vilifying the 1%. I do think when he says, obviously I'm going to raise taxes, but only on people whose incomes are over $400,000. Obviously that's, that's the 1% that we're talking about there, but he's really just talking about reversing the Trump tax cut for, essentially for billionaires and 100 millionaires. And that doesn't go nearly far enough to address income inequality, because, of course, we had a massive income inequality problem before the Trump tax cut, before Trump was even running for president. Occupy Wall Street was 2011. That situation was not of Trump's making. So I do think that if you look at what is being proposed in terms of spending proposals, that clearly that tax revenue is going to come from somewhere. So there is going to be, I don't know what form that's going to take. I don't know if that's a Warren-style wealth tax or I like this pandemic tax for the massive jumps in wealth that a handful of billionaires have seen during the pandemic. That's a great idea that Bernie had. I don't know what form those things are going to take, but I do think that the basic proposals that the sort of slate of Democratic candidates were putting forward, all of that was pre-pandemic, right? Biden already had this thing locked up before we realized we were living in a pandemic, perhaps. We sort of now realize that the pandemic was really here in January. We just didn't let ourselves start thinking of it until early March, and our federal leadership, failed to really alert us about it until early March, really the second week in March. So the platforms that these candidates put together were not really anticipating the pandemic. And I do believe, I think that there are lots of signs, and I have some hope, that Biden recognizes the pandemic as necessitating a strong and even transformational policy response. He realizes that there is an opportunity there to really fix some big things, because the American people realize more than ever that some very big things are very wrong. And I believe that Biden wants to be opportunistic about that.
Well, I am not only late for our only break of the hour, we are loaded with phone calls and emails. And in our next 20 minutes, we'll get through as much as we can with Jay Levine, a longtime Democratic volunteer organizer who supported Elizabeth Warren in the primary, Robin Wilt, a former candidate for Congress and a member of the Brighton Town Board who supported Bernie Sanders in the primary. And we'll come right back with your feedback after our only break. Coming up in our second hour, we're talking about deep fakes. Videos, pictures, audio that look real but aren't. Videos of President Trump, President Obama, Joe Biden, Vladimir Putin get shared pretty quickly before people realize it's a fake. Now artists have something to say about it. We're talking about the threat of deepfakes next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Last winter in the primary season, Democrats had to ask if they were going to be able to unify, whether it was Bernie Sanders or Pete Buttigieg or Amy Klobuchar or eventually Joe Biden. And our guests this hour are Democrats who supported not Joe Biden in the primary. And one of our guests joining us a little later in the hour is David Zavac, who has experience in politics and supported Amy Klobuchar in the primary. And David's on the line with us now. How are you, David?
Hey, doing good. How are you?
Good. Why don't you first give us a sense for why it was Amy Klobuchar for you in the primary and not somebody else like Joe Biden?
I was pretty negative about Joe Biden in general. I guess not really a younger voter anymore, but I didn't like the idea of sort of going backwards in terms of generations. I was looking for somebody a little younger early on. And Amy Klobuchar is just somebody that I've followed in the Senate for a long time. And, she has performed really well in Minnesota elections. We think of Minnesota as a Democratic state, but she's sort of run ahead of what, you know, would be expected of a generic. So I've always thought in terms of electability, she'd be pretty high. And, while she ended up running as quite the moderate, there were a lot of policies, you know, certain things like tax credits for parents, things like that, that I think are quite progressive that she had, you know, supported sort of well before, you know, someone like Biden did. So I saw her as sort of a space in the middle of a Bernie or a Biden, if you're looking, you know, for an ideological, you know, middle ground. So that's kind of why I liked Amy. And I also just thought, in terms of like competence, you know, if there had been a Trump Klobuchar debate, I just think she's sharp enough that I think she would have done quite well.
And David, you know, when I'm my prognostications are always wrong, so we take that with a grain of salt. I'm the guy who said Marco Rubio was going to be president. I have a long history of really embarrassing calls, so I'm going to stop making calls.
A lot of people said that, Evan. Don't feel bad.
But David, you know, when it comes to Klobuchar, I thought, you know, where Clinton sort of underperformed in the Midwest, she would do well in the Midwest. I thought she could win states like Ohio. You're in Ohio. Doesn't appear that Biden will win Ohio, though I don't know. How do you see Biden and support among Democrats coalescing, and how have your own feelings about Biden moved? You know, I'm curious to know how you think Ohio is moving in the next 6 days.
I think if you look at the way Biden debated against Trump in the two debates versus I thought a lot of times in the primaries, he really, really struggled. Maybe it was the crowded field. I don't know. But I thought Biden really performed better than I would have expected. I think if you look at his climate plan, if you look at some of the policies, maybe that really he's only embraced because of COVID. In terms of looking for progressive policies, I think he's come, you know, my way, maybe not enough to make, you know, some of the, you know, Bernie Sanders supporters, you know, happy.
As Rob has established, but yeah.
I think he's taken some steps, you know, towards, you know, the progressive part of the party. Now he still takes shots every once in a while. I would be surprised if Biden won Ohio, but I think if you look at the way he's campaigned, I think it would be difficult to really criticize him too much. I mean, if the 538, you know, average is that he's up by 9 right now, you know, maybe that's right, maybe it's wrong, but if that's the best information we have, he's doing something right. And so I think the fact that, you know, I think Trump ended up winning Ohio by 8 plus points 4 years ago. I think if Ohio is competitive, that's a good sign in the first place. I don't think he necessarily has to get over the top here, and I wouldn't expect it.
Well, let me get as much feedback as I can from listeners. I'm going to start with Jackson in Rochester. Go ahead, Jackson.
Hey, Evan. This is Jackson Cavalier calling. So I just want to make a statement. I know this has kind of already been addressed, but I was a Bernie supporter. I'm 26 years old. And I mean, honestly, I don't know anyone in my age group that is happily voting for Biden. It seems like we're all kind of dragging our feet. And it seems like a lot of millennials in general kind of understand at this point that the Democratic Party is not willing to bend. It seems like the only way progressive change is going to happen is if we get more progressives in there. So I know a lot of people are really unhappy with the fact that Biden is our candidate now, but are voting because, fascism is on the bill on the other side. So we're basically trying to get ahead of it, and we're trying to keep pushing Biden left. But I'm worried because of the fact that, you know, the lack of enthusiasm, in my mind, it could very likely lead to another 4 years of Trump. It seems, you know, back in 2016, a lot of Democrats were overconfident that Hillary Clinton was going to win. And because of that, you know, it just led to this situation that we're in now. And I'm worried that, you know, history is bound to repeat itself.
Well, let me just read an email for you there, Jackson. You can tell me if this resonates at all. Mark says, Evan, I think Biden understands his role in this election. He's our transition or rebound candidate in this race. Like getting out of a bad relationship, he's the guy between the old relationship, which was not good for you, and the new one, which in many ways will be better. I believe we as a nation can't make that big a leap all at once. We need a bridge, and Biden can be it. That's from Mark. What do you think?
I feel like that is a decent analogy, but I also feel like the Democrats, I'm very left-leaning, but I'm not with the current state of the Democratic Party. I'm definitely more of a Bernie-crat and even farther left than that in certain degrees. But I feel as if Trump is an abusive partner that is physically abusive, while Biden may more likely be a verbally abusive one, where he's going to say things, but he can't really follow through. And, you know, it creates this gaslighting situation that I feel like, you know, even if he does win, we're going to have to work really hard to push him left and get progressive policies passed.
Well, I appreciate the perspective. And on that subject, let me snag Teddy in Fairport to add to that. Go ahead, Teddy.
Thank you, Evan. Well, so I was a part of the Bernie campaign, and I happened to be at Robin Wilkes' house when she was beginning to drum up support for him. So I nod to her and let her know that she has my support. Also, I want to ask Robin if she recognizes that I think ignorance or a lack of education and basically the connection between Biden and Obama gained him a great deal of, certain demographics votes. I wish that those individuals had the wherewithal to recognize how much more for their rights Bernie was. I see that Robin noticed that. But I want to ask her, what is she prepared to do? Because we're seeing the pragmatists say you can't get people to vote for their best interests because they are too well indoctrinated against socialism or whatever. How are you going to create a heroic example if you are to move forward in any capacity to forward that issue?
All right, Teddy, thank you. Robin Wilt, go ahead.
And Teddy, I think that's a great question. And I think ultimately politics is always all about relationships. And I think that Biden was able to secure validators within some of the communities that Bernie Sanders was not able to secure the same validators. And that was key to Biden eventually benefiting from this surge of voters who went his way. And I think that often on the left, we have these great policy initiatives that we know are going to benefit the communities that we're trying to support, but we don't take time to build relationships within those communities. And so, we can't just talk about policy. We have to talk about building trust in those communities, because that is what is going to really forge the coalition in the left that needs to happen. And we need to have that conversation, not just in the context of the grassroots, but we also need to basically join our party. We think that we can come around every 4 years during a presidential election and try to engage in and influence, but that's not possible. We have to be building in between those presidential elections, and that means getting involved.
David Zavek, is there a future for socialism on the left? Do you think that young voters will embrace it, and do you want to see it?
I think yes, in some ways. I think, you know, you've seen a big embrace from the Democratic Party of cash transfers on a level that would have been unthinkable a couple of years ago. You know, we had seen decades of you know, favoring things like food stamps and subsidies. And now you're seeing a big swing towards, you know, actually giving parents money or bigger, you know, child tax credits. Obviously, there was the $600, you know, per week unemployment benefit. So I think on one hand, you have that. Then you see what President Trump has done with farmers in terms of direct cash handouts. I mean, I don't know that it's going to be branded as socialism, but I think in terms of a strong social safety net and that gets, you know, benefits directly to people as opposed to making them jump through lots of hoops, I think the left has had a lot of success just in the last 2 or 3 years. Sometimes you're winning and you don't really even, you know, take a step back until you see how much, you know, the policy has shifted. And even in terms of something like Medicare for All, I think a huge, you know, a much larger percentage of the Democratic Party is in favor of getting rid of things like private insurance than you would have seen 10 years ago. Or to give another example, look at the public option. The public option for Obamacare was something that only the furthest left members of the Democratic Party supported 10 years ago. Now, I mean, Joe, I did have to look it up, but I'd guess you have somebody like Joe Manchin in favor of a public option. So things are moving. You look at a guy like Joe Biden, and it's hard to see the movement, but I think it does exist.
Okay. Jay Levine, you've said that you think over the age of 50 or over the age of 60, Democrats aren't going to have any patience for the word socialism. What about younger Democrats, and do you think there's a future for it in the party?
I'm going to say no. I'm going to say that there's no future for it in the party because there's no future for it in this country. And I think that, you know, younger Democrats who say they support socialism could not capably explain to you the difference between socialism and communism, what little difference there actually is. So I think that it's been an unfortunate, you know, Bernie Sanders has added so much to our public discussion of these issues. He's contributed so much. He's moved the Democratic Party in a positive direction in so many ways. But one thing he has done an awful job of is sort of confusing and conflating these terms of socialism versus social democracy, which is simply having, you know, a capitalism-based economy, but with a very strong, you know, a set of social programs.
Something Scandinavian,
A very strong social safety net, right. And that's not socialism. If you ask any Scandinavian country, are you socialist? They'll say, no, of course not. We're social democracies. And so, you know, the term socialism shouldn't be, you know, anywhere in the discussion. I can't speak for the entire left, of course, because there's plenty of people on the left who do want to talk about socialism, even those who know what it is. But for the most part, you know, the actual socialism has extremely little support in American politics and extremely little support in the Democratic Party. I will do a small sort of fact correction to your last call. Your callers are very interesting and knowledgeable people, by the way. And the public option actually had strong, I'd say, supermajority support among the Democratic caucus. It just we couldn't get to 60 votes in the Senate in 2009. For the public option.
I think the point was it couldn't pass.
It's just letting everybody. The public option, in case people aren't totally clear on it, is just giving everyone the option to buy into Medicaid. That's all. It's essentially just lowering the Medicaid age to zero. Medicare. Mm. Pardon me. Medicare, not Medicaid. Mm. Right.
Yeah.
I slipped the tongue. So. No. So yeah. It's. But understand that to get to 58 or 57 votes in the Senate. for something means that there is strong supermajority support across the country because the Senate is so tilted to the right compared to where the country is as a whole. So even in 2008, public option was already something that had majority support in this country.
I got to let Robin
Wolf
take.
It's amazing we don't have it yet.
I got to let Robin take about the last 30 seconds. Go ahead, Robin.
Well, I wouldn't say that definitely there is greater understanding of what a democratic socialist is. And Bernie Sanders obviously has led to raising awareness around that. And we see candidates winning as democratic socialists in a number of cities. We see that in Seattle. We see that in Portland. We see that more and more. Even in New York State, we have candidates who are running as legitimate democratic socialists, even if they're running on the Democratic line. So this is a continuing conversation. I mean, I definitely think that millennials are part of that change in perception.
Well, one of our listeners, Andrew, says, Evan, you're having this conversation too early. We got to have an election first. I know. I take that point. I am not at all making any predictions anymore ever again, no matter what the 538 estimates are or otherwise. This is just a look at whether there's been coalescing in the Democratic Party. Robin Wilt, always good. Thank you for the time.
Thank you for having me, Evan.
David Zavak, thanks for squeezing it in. Nice talking to you.
Hey, always happy to be here. Thank you.
Jay Levine, thank you, sir.
You're welcome. And Robin, good luck in your future runs.
All right. Listeners, I was gonna thank Rob and Megan, but we still have an hour of connection. Should we do another hour, Rob? Rob says, yeah. We're going to do another one. We'll be right back.